What is a high-performing culture? It's a question as straightforward as it is philosophical. In the coming special episodes, we explore high-performing cultures, what they are, how to create them, and most importantly, how not just to maintain them, but scale them. By drawing upon the wisdom of the previous CEOs, founders, and leaders who I've had the pleasure of interviewing over the last 6 years. Now more than ever, culture scaling is the biggest single issue that executives lose sleep over at night. This first episode, we traverse the integral topic of values, why they are important, and how they have to be at the center of every decision made and every behavior exhibited in a business, and also how best to do this. I'm Ed Cowan, and this is episode one of the Culture Scaling Playbook. For the last 5 years, I've had the absolute pleasure of hosting Scaling Up, a podcast telling the growth stories of some of the most successful private and public companies globally, as told by their founders, CEOs, and other key leaders, who between them have created some $150 billion in market capitalization. After 42 episodes of Scaling Up and 300,000 words of interview transcripts, we now have an amazing database of knowledge to dive into and pull some common threads together across a range of topics. This episode is wholly dedicated to the role values play in successfully scaling people and culture. I'm excited to bring the moments that have stuck with me long after the stop button has been pressed on the recording. To start with, though, it's important to understand what is a high-performing culture, a word that can be easily used as an intangible catch-all, and why it is at the heart of the success of great teams and great companies. My own experience of culture was born in sporting teams. I was very lucky to play in teams that saw both triumph and disappointment. I became fascinated with why these teams won and why we sometimes lost, how players interacted with each other throughout each of these, what was correlation and what was causation. When I retired from sport almost 6 years ago, having it consume my life for the best part of two professional decades, the similarities to me as to what made a great sports team and what made a high-performing business were blindingly stark. It's very hard to be a championship team without A-grade players. But I saw time and time again, it was the cohesion of these players that mattered most. It was also clear to me that to sustain success, there was an underlying magic based in systems and processes that allowed for this cohesion. It requires an egoless buying in from all, that the team comes first. Players believe that the higher order is team success over personal success and would always sacrifice the latter for the former. This is completely analogous to scaling the team in a high-performance culture of a fast-paced business. It just does not happen by accident. And of course, in the rare case it does, it's never sustainable. And at some point, the business will hit a wall. And it's not just going to inhibit future growth, but in many respects can unwind previous steps in building long-term competitive advantage. To back up these thoughts, a quote from Steve Hansen, the most successful sports coach of the most successful team in history, the All Blacks, rings loudly in my ears.
All good teams, and I think companies would be the same, they have clear drivers, things like team is first, individual second. They live their values from the top down, so they're not just things they put on the wall and then forget about. They identify the critical few that are so important for them to be successful, and they do that really well, and they concentrate on that, and they work hard at getting those right every day. They're adaptable in their thinking, they're flexible in their thinking, so they can change in the moment if they need to, or they can learn faster than the opposition.
This sounds like the same recipe for a successful company to me. So with this in mind, what is indeed culture? One of the best frameworks I have heard is from Anna Binder, head of people and culture at Asana. She likens it to the area of a triangle, where the three defining points are the mission, values, and decision-making. In her own words, and far better articulated than this, here is Anna herself.
I ask people to imagine in their mind's eye a triangle, and at the top of that triangle is the mission. That is really the North Star and the very top of the triangle. At the other corner of the triangle are the values. whatever they are for your organization. For us, it's 9 things. These are the things we endeavor to show up with each other by. We don't always get it right, and we have good days and bad days, but these are our commitments of effort. This is how we're going to show up with each other. And then the third part of the triangle is, you know, I shorthanded it to the 10,000 things, the 10,000 decisions that we collectively make really every day in all aspects of the company. It is financial decisions that we make and where we allocate budget. It is what features go into the free version of the product and what features go into the paid version of the product. There are, you know, literally tens of thousands of these. And the way that I think about culture is our collective work to make those 10,000 decisions in a way that allows us to achieve our mission while being in line with our values. And if you create a triangle around those 3 things, in the middle of that, that's where your culture lives.
Culture, though, is never stagnant. It's a living and breathing organism. It does not live on a page or a wall. It's always growing organically, whether teams tend to it or not. And this is why the triangle framework, in my mind, is so useful, as it provides boundaries as to where it can grow and thrive, and do so in a constructive, vibrant way. It also alludes to the fact that every culture is different. Each point of the triangle will vary from company to company. There's no right or wrong cultures. There are just effective or ineffective ones. For those that want to hear more from Anna, one of the world's best people and culture leaders in my mind, her episode was episode 6 of series 5 of Scaling Up, and it's well worth listening to in its entirety. One thing that will definitely emerge from this episode is the role values play in this. And without exhausting the analogies too early, there's a lovely image that may resonate with you as it did with me in regards to scaling culture, provided by Joel Montagnol, CEO of Seven Rooms.
As we think about growing the company, the image I'll give to people often is rings of a tree. And the next group of people we hire, the outer ring, and it's really their job to protect the culture. And the core values really help layer in and strengthen the glue across all of the rings.
A key piece of the puzzle is why scaling culture effectively is so important. There are entire library aisles full of books here, deeply based in data, that have effectively and conclusively drawn a link between effective cultures and business outcomes. You can simply not decouple great people from great outcomes. And time again, we've heard great leaders say their greatest asset is their people. In regards to attracting and supporting A-grade talent, the famous Steve Jobs quote comes to mind. The secret of my success is that we've gone to exceptional lengths to hire the best people in the world. Ethan Berman was the CEO and founder of RiskMetrics that listed on the New York Stock Exchange in 2010, and he was very clear on his job. It was to ensure that RiskMetrics was the world's best employer. His hypothesis was that culture would trump remuneration in regards to recruiting and retaining the best talent. Here is Ethan, now a TDM operating advisor, on this exact topic.
My objective is to make RiskMetrics the world's best employer. And that's what we want to be. Because if you are the world's best employer, you will be successful, regardless of what business you're in. And I said this, I said, you know, our competition is not other risk management firms. Our competition at the time was, you know, Google, was Goldman Sachs, was McKinsey. You know, the places that parents want their kids to go and kids getting out of the top schools want to join. And, you know, I think that that really became sort of our mantra on what our success was going to be. And, you know, that's hard as a small company. And the most important thing I learned from that was you don't get there by simply saying we're going to pay people more money. That is not going to be the key to being the world's best employer. In fact, you could argue that they tend to go inverse, that if you need to be the highest employer, then that is the only thing you have. And if that's the only reason people work at your company, then I don't think that's long-term sustainable.
Of course, high performance in any field by its very nature is not just rare, but incredibly hard, both physically and emotionally, but it is never at the sacrifice of enjoyment. In fact, while many think of these as competing tensions, in my experience, they're actually hand in glove with productive cultures. High-performing employees value collective achievement and their contribution to it far more in many cases than wealth. And one quote stood out to me that encapsulates this, and it came from Hugh Williams, who had an incredible career solving some of the world's most advanced technical problems for Microsoft, eBay, and Google, among others. And this is Hugh discussing some of this secret sauce in the high-performing teams he was a part of and led.
So you get these incredibly motivated people who are really, really smart, who want to be in teams and go and drive and do things. So at Microsoft, we were all working together. You know, we were a group of people focused on one outcome, and we were driving as hard as we could to go and get that outcome. And, you know, I remember in my early days at Microsoft being a bit sad when it got to be the weekend, you know, like it got to be sort of Friday at 5 o'clock, and I'm like, oh, what a bummer, I've got a day off tomorrow. Now, of course, I loved going home and hanging out with my wife and my young kids at the time, and that was fantastic too. But you're like, oh, do we have to stop now? You know, this is awesome. And so I worked phenomenally hard, and the time went incredibly quickly because it was just such a great set of people to work with, and I felt like we were really making a difference really, really fast.
So what are the benefits of having a passionate, engaged, and highly productive A-grade employee base? And I don't want to be too obvious here, but we know that it reduces the cost base. World-class employees are far more efficient, and if they feel like they are deeply valued and aligned to the company, retention's far easier. And as your employer brand grows, so is recruitment. The cost to the business of great talent leaving is immense. You not only have to try and replace them, which is both costly in time and money, but the gap they leave in the meantime can have a compounding and outsized detrimental impact on those who are directly in the orbit of the now ex-employee. More importantly, though, is we know it drives the top-line growth. Aside from this being incredibly efficient growth, great teams are far more innovative by their very nature, and that innovation will be targeted. It will be customer-centric, it will be business outcome-orientated, and ultimately, it will drive long-term revenue growth as new products or better products are built and sold. Much has been made of this. Reed Hastings of Netflix coined it talent density, and how to foster it, be it hiring stunning employees and promoting employee freedom, but the data around this is compelling. I've been lucky enough to have seen Didier Elzinger, the co-founder and CEO of CultureAmp, in action at close quarters. CultureAmp has the largest proprietary data set as it relates to culture, with over 6,000 customers, and I've seen Didier present some of their research as it relates to this data. For private companies, it's not the quantum of funding that makes companies innovative. Rather than having a culture that emphasizes innovation that will make you most likely to receive funding. In fact, companies with high engagement and confidence in both the company and its leadership are also a leading indicator for public companies. And this is also true. Positive employee perception metrics are leading indications of stock price success. I'll post a blog to this research in the accompanying notes to this podcast, as I'm sure a few listeners will want to dive in further. Values. When do they get formalized? This episode is dedicated from here on the role values play in successfully scaling people and culture. And their importance cannot be understated. They have to be at the center of every decision made and every behavior exhibited in the business. Values are the cultural guardrails, from setting strategy to customer interactions to the full employee experience. Every split moment, every micro decision has to be within these guardrails that the values of the business provides. The values have to be the glue that binds the business together. And I like to think of them as the foundations to which the business is built on. And of course, these are unique to each and every company. The most listened to Scaling Up episode has in fact been the very first one. And given it was the first episode, it was certainly a little raw and rough around the edges, but people gravitate to listening to it to hear the irrepressible founder and CEO of Guzman y Gomez, Stephen Marks. Now, Guzman has five values, and I'll read them out. It's all about the food. Make every customer love us. Be real. Got your back. It's up to us. Now, I'll highlight these because in the space of 2 minutes of that episode, on a conversation totally unrelated to values, every single one of these values permeates deeply in a response Stephen gave about his wider team.
Right at this point in time, you know, we have 4,000 people in the restaurants. There is no GYG without them. We're one family and we're one team. And that's a genuine way I look at it. When we were starting as well, and people were like, so what are your values? And I mean, values, I thought that was like some sort of bullshit thing you have in the back of a door. But I realized that we really have values. You know, and my business partner would say to me, dude, this is what you talk about all day long.
I'm going to allude to this right through this episode, but I'm going to be explicit here. the most important trait of a good set of values is that they guide behaviors, decisions, and actions in a way that is consistent with the organization's purpose and underlying cultural identity, especially in times of adversity. What became apparent throughout all the recorded Scaling Up episodes is the tension that can exist when it comes to value. And it's a positive tension of both setting and living these values and how this permeates through the organization. By virtue of the fact that the values are usually born or representative of the initial forging moments of a small team, when is the right time to formalize them? Is the process top-down or bottoms-up? Can they change over time? As it relates to the first question, there is a time when the founding team look up and realize that there is a deep need to be a codification of all the behaviors that they have initially taken for granted. It is rarely intentional words on a page that are planned for before the rubber hits the road. In Kate Morris's case at Adore Beauty, a now ASX-listed e-commerce business, it was the moment when she had made some hasty hires and the cultural wheels had started to wobble because of it. Once that short period of toxicity had subsided, they sat down to ensure that that would never happen again. Or in her words...
So we all worked together on putting together a list of cultural values, which basically represented, okay, when things are great here, when things are going really well, what behaviours are we seeing? What are the sort of consistent threads of the things that make it good to be here or make this a good company or, you know, or, I mean, and a high-performing company as well. And to work together on that list of values that we then have ever since used as sort of the fundamental pieces of recruitment, of performance management. If you ask anybody here, we'd bang on about the values all of the time because we expect everybody to be able to use those key values as decision-making tools on a day-to-day basis. Yeah.
The call that I would make here is that for authentic values to scale, they must require cut-through. They have to be unique and representative of the people inside the organisation. They need to avoid pithy one-word genericism that can often be conflated with other intended ideas. Or worse still, they just become white noise. Couching values in colloquial phrases used in the corridors can be great for this. As an example, close to home, one of TDM's values is wear the yellow hat, and it was born out of a total misunderstanding of Edward de Bono's six-hat thinking, and it's a humorous origin story, but it's now a very common phrase here at TDM. It's become almost slang for, I'm looking for the courage to be a little vulnerable, perhaps think a bit differently by asking what otherwise might be perceived as a silly question. And it's this colloquialism around the corridors that's permeated into meetings and beyond to anywhere people are requesting just some form of psychological safety. For Mike Frizzell and James Edwards, the two co-founders of Australia's largest online pet retailer, PetCircle, the instigation for their values was the formal hire of a head of people and culture. And at the same time, it was them themselves who had stopped doing all the hiring. They needed to formalise what they valued. And like everything that those two had done, it was very deliberate. And to hear why, here's Mike.
And we never got comfortable with the idea of writing values or culture because our belief, and we probably didn't articulate at the time, was it has to be real and it has to be us. And so writing something down and seeking input in a small company from what everyone wants it to be wouldn't be real. So it took us a long time to kind of resolve what's made us a good team and what makes the people around us a good team is what is the culture. And so our job was to reflect that. This is the culture. And it came out, we've got five now. And so it took us a while to sit down and be comfortable with what the commonality was. And it's actually not what most startups are. Come there is be individual. You had good words. You didn't call it a culture. We called it like a work contract.
Ways of working or something like that.
This is a contract between you and your peers about how you'll treat each other.
Because we thought about it as what you do at work. Like when you turn up to work, what can you expect from the business and from the people you're working with within the business? And that's where we wanted to start and end it.
What did become surprisingly apparent to me that I'd not factored in coming from a singular team sport was the possibility for multiple cultures to coexist inside a business, be it because of geography in a global business and various local offices moulding variations, or depending on the type of business, different organisation departments having distinct cultures. And it now makes sense. The warehouse team in a consumer business will operate differently to the marketing team. In a software business, the engineers have significantly different workflow to the sales reps. But as it relates to values, and this is, I guess, the point as it relates to the values acting as a work contract, as Mike put it, these multiple cultures are all right for the people that they serve. The culture is what makes the team feel comfortable, engaged, and productive. But they have to sit and fit under these core values of the business. They can't be incongruent with the values in any shape, way, or form. And one prominent theme that did emerge that can sit side by side in this framework of values as a work contract relates to this horizontal thread of mission and purpose. Ultimately, the purpose of any business is to serve the customer. And this usually plays into the formulation, codification, and living of the values by high-performing employees. Here is a snippet from an interview I did some years ago now with Jonathan Corr, the then CEO of Ellie Mae, before it was bought and sold again for $11 billion US.
The culture in many ways just started with Sig pretty quickly as he surrounded himself with people, you know, folks that shared a common viewpoint. And then the culture really became the people here. And so, you know, it's always been, in many ways, we used to talk about, you know, a high-tech company with old-fashioned values, but it's been about, you know, being focused on our customers, building great products, great services, and really thinking about the relationship with our customers as a partnership, as a relationship. And so knowing that that is the case, you know, how do you make sure that you are open and honest and transparent and are listening and responsive and make the customers feel that way?
Living the values and codifying them both formally and informally. Of course, core values are meaningless if they're simply words on a wall. Operators need to understand how to scale these behaviors that they represent. They need to codify these behaviors that underlie the values, make them both actionable and crystal clear as to their intent. An example that keeps coming to mind is the one Joel Montagnier left me with. Their value, put everything on the table, a pun to their restaurant serving software, of course, is the idea that they should be able to be fully transparent and honest with each other. There shouldn't be anything that they can't say, and by putting everything on the table, you ultimately get to the best outcome. And so, for instance, at the end of meetings, the question will be asked, did we put everything on the table? It gives a final opportunity, space, and permission to speak up, express doubts, challenge ideas. The posters or murals on the wall are lip service unless employees know what the values are well lived. One of the best culture handbooks I've seen has been produced by Rokt. Bruce Buchanan, you'll hear right throughout this series, gives very explicit behaviours expected for the different levels of the organisational ladder. Those expectations diverge greatly depending on where you sit on it. While obvious, the standard expected of the C-suite vastly differ to those of a first-year graduate. But importantly, it's clear to all employees what they are and to what they'll be held accountable to. Rick Stolmeyer, founder of MindBody, had a very simple framework to help this codification, and I think best to hear it from him.
Best way to explain any core value is to discuss the opposite of it. One of our core values is humble and helpful. Well, it's really easy to explain the importance of that because imagine the opposite, arrogant and unhelpful. I don't care how talented you are, you don't belong here if you are arrogant and unhelpful, and we will not tolerate. The organization will literally expel such a person if they manage to fool us enough to get hired.
This is also true for the positive extremes of any singular core value and why attaching behaviors to each is so important. It's also why the more narrowly they're defined, the less likely they're going to be weaponized in ways that are odds with their intention. Living a value to a radical endpoint leads to as many poor outcomes as living the antithesis of the value in the first place. Bill Magnuson, CEO and co-founder of Braze, articulated how they overcome this to some degree. With incoming hires during his CEO values workshop, he tries to articulate what is hard about living each value. Values are at their most valuable when people disagree, or you need to prioritize and make tough decisions.
So one of ours is don't ignore smoke. And so what this value is actually impressing upon you is not that you should just like complain about everything you see, but rather that we need to act with urgency when something might be wrong. When you see smoke and you say something, you know, the people around you should help. Not only do we not shoot the messenger, we actually embrace them. And, you know, really communicating what it is about the value that is hard, I think, is the most important part. So I think embracing that and a communication of the values right out of the gate is really valuable as well.
Of course, constantly reinforcing what great looks like with values well lived is also crucial to allow the behaviours to permeate and become the norm. Sounds funny, but culture scaling is reliant on this normalisation of what has forever been taken for granted. The cultural iconography or artefacts here plays such a strong role. Mike Sabinas at League, a Canadian healthcare scale-up, from day one has used culture cards at town hall meetings to symbolise more than a token of appreciation, but a moment of recognition amongst all peers to call out and activate exemplars of living the values. Phil McKenzie at Pacific Smiles has done something similar, using storytelling and symbolism too via a similar method. While a small gesture, it is the meaning behind them that can be so galvanising to fast-growing teams, to shine a light on culture carriers who otherwise and usually go about their business without fuss, setting an example in the shadows for others to follow their actions. Humans have thrived on storytelling to scale behaviours for thousands of years. The modern age of company building should be no different. Of course, in a fast-growing company, almost by definition, headcount is growing at least in line with top-line growth. A doubling of headcount for two consecutive years will mean 75% of the team will be new to the organisation over that period of time. The values that have been defined by a small number are now lived by so many. The easiest in theory but hardest in practice way to ensure new employee values alignment is to use the values as both a recruiting tool but also a clear test right throughout the interview process. Not to do this is just flirting with extreme danger, and I've seen at close quarters what bad actors can do to the culture of a team. Their behaviour becomes the acceptable standard, and very quickly the norm for everyone else, sadly. Values and hiring, from interviewing to onboarding and beyond. Perhaps the most important takeaway from all the interviews I've conducted is the role that values play in the hiring process. Here's Paul Bassett, who is a co-founder of Seek, reflecting on his own experience.
My skills as a leader are, I think I'm very good at identifying talent and I've always optimized for values alignment and raw ability over experience. I think experience is the most overrated attribute in hiring. Not that it's unimportant, but a lot of areas we just over-index for experience.
Bruce Buchanan, the CEO and co-founder of Rokt, also really stressed this during episode 2 of the very first series of Scaling Up. Here's Bruce.
I don't do anymore. So once we got to 180 or something, we trained up a bunch of people in the business that do what we call bar raises, and they answer three key questions. The bar raises are from some other part of the business, and the bar raiser process is three questions. Is this person aligned with our values, which is a yes or no?
Yeah.
Where does this person spike in competencies? And the last question we ask people is, will this person raise the bar of the team they're going in?
Ana Binder, who you've already heard from in this episode, the CPO of Asana and one of the best CPOs I've seen in action, talks about the crispness that is required to avoid cultural bias. That is being able to hide behind hiring just a cultural fit rather than a cultural ad. And while it might sound like semantics, the former can be round down to what it looks and feels like to an interviewer. The latter actually defining down to the exact question, what exactly are you testing for and how? And to avoid as you scale, those interviewing simply making up their own components. Here's Anna in more detail going into this.
It's a handful of our values, not all of our values, but a handful of our values that we can translate into something that we can assess in an interview. You know, one of the things that's really important to us is a growth mindset. In order to have a growth mindset, you need to have both a commitment to self-improvement and an openness to being wrong and a comfort with talking about your mistakes. That is something that you can assess for in an interview.
As part of the interview process at Allbirds, the company values are used right throughout screening, but then more deeply towards the back end. Once competencies are accounted for, they use the values as an opportunity for candidates to both opt out or, importantly, emphatically opt in. Here's Joey, the co-CEO.
It's a 3-page document that we share with every final round interview candidate, and these candidates get to self-select whether they're inspired by it or whether they think it's, you know, a couple of guys in San Francisco with flowers in their hair. And it's a way to separate the wheat from the chaff, and that is a powerful thing to get an incredibly aligned group of people who happen to be very diverse of skill set, diverse of background, and bring that diversity of thought with an aligned set of values and mission into something that is focused, and that can be very powerful.
But hiring is just the moment of the employee experience for both parties to ensure there's values alignment. The next is onboarding and initiation in the expected behaviours attached to these values. And this can come from many forms, and usually brought physically to life in and around the office, or in the world of hybrid work, more asynchronously, be it in the form of live or recorded leadership-led workshops. There are, of course, other common practices that explicitly formalise these as well, like handbooks or culture codes. And there are many examples of these that have made their way to the public domain, like those of Netflix or Asana. To alleviate the key friction, you need to make these practices both scalable and authentic in the first instance, and then the processes to consistently remind and embed these values in the day-to-day workflow. Without this embedding, there can be no call to accountability from peers or leaders alike. Alisa Healy, one of the great cricketers of this generation, talked to a ritual of the Australian cricket team when it came to values. You need to remember, in a national team sports selection, there's no interview process to speak of. And so there's always this overweight bias to performance. That is not to say a player's ability to add to the culture is not taken into account at the selection table. But there are few unknowns in sport at the elite level. And at the very point of that pyramid, most cultural detractors have already been identified and probably weeded out. Here she is describing, like all things in professional sport, an intense, direct, and incredibly powerful ritual.
One thing that really stands out for me in the accountability piece is we've obviously got a pretty well set values. For us, when a new player comes into the side, as daunting as it might be, you're standing there in front of, you know, Meg Lanning, Elise Perry, that you've kind of looked up to growing up, learning the game, and you come into the side. One of the first things that you've got to do coming into the squad is actually present your version of those values in front of the group of people. First and foremost, I think it makes a hell of an experience for that person. It makes a great experience for us watching, but I think ultimately it makes that person, new person coming into the group, instantly more comfortable in the environment, because they've got to speak, they've got to talk to us about how they're going to live the values, what it looks like for them, whether that's on the field, off the field. And at the end of the day, it makes each and every one of us accountable for that person living out those values. It makes them accountable. They've said it out loud. You know, we can enact, say, you know what, you're not living up to that today, or well done, pat on the back, you're actually living those values.
Once employees know what these values are, understand what is expected of them, and while obvious in theory, it's imperative to provide clear and consistent feedback as it relates to employee performance, particularly as it relates to culture, given how impactful countercultural actions can be. And this is where the values as clear guiding rails are so valuable. In a pure sense, and maybe my sports background fogs my lens, a manager's job is, to me, actually that of a coach's. And the best coaches I had were always about setting their players up for success, like a great manager should of employees. This can come as simply showing them how they can meet and exceed the explicit cultural expectations and measuring them against these. This comes from caring about behaviour over results in the short term, knowing the right employees with the right behaviours will drive outcomes you desire. The values can be objectively measured against simply enough. It is ensuring the systems and processes are set up to both provide and receive feedback on these grounds, and also creating incentives for those who do in fact become culture carriers, be it through remuneration or other forms of recognition and responsibility. The need for this only increases in the executive suite, where their example permeates through an organisation. But with the threshold being slightly more binary, if a leader is not being a shining light of living the values, this should have an outsized impact on their reviews, their compensation, and ultimately, actually, if they belong in the company, irrespective of the other outcomes they deliver. We have another episode dedicated to hiring and retaining these high performers, and this tiny droplet was illustrative of the role values can play as an underlying measurement tool. The last thing to shine a light on as it relates to culture scaling is the age-old question of whether or not a company can refresh or even change its values. My colleague James Revell wrote a wonderful blog post on this very topic after our Culture Summit last year. His checklist intended to help teams with their next values discussion, be it in the context of re-examining or reforming them. There'll be a link in the show notes to these, and make sure you check them out. It really is one of the best versions I've seen. The argument for not changing your values is as simple as it is compelling, and it's based on the premise that values are your identity and your identity is there from the beginning. And what I've learnt more broadly over curating almost 50 episodes of Scaling Up is that values can often require honing or slight refinement over time. And almost using a similar approach to what I previously described by Bill Magnuson, when considering the modern relevancy of your values, if the answer to the very simple question as to what is hard about living them, and the answer is not much, then I suggest they need a further razor-sharp refinement as your business has grown. All the topics we've discussed in this episode lead to this very point. If your values don't satisfy a simple checklist, and in some instances they were developed many years ago and the business was fundamentally a different business, do they help decision-making? Do they help us drive towards a certain performance outcome? Do they help us evaluate and reward certain behaviours? Are they easily understood? Do they bridge cultural boundaries? Are they easily memorable? If the answer to any of these questions is no, or you aren't sure, I suggest it's a time to re-examine them in some shape, way, or form. If you do go down the path of refreshing your values, there are two guiding principles. Firstly, you need to ensure that their current perceived dysfunction does not lie in how the values are not being reflected in behaviours or decisions being made in the organisation before you amend the what, that is the values themselves. Simply spinning up new values won't solve for this. Secondly, just a reminder, I guess, you can't change what you stand for and represent. And so be really mindful the process will be, by its very importance, long and inclusive, and importantly should simply refine the ideas behind the existing values and express them in a way that is more useful to the organisation in its current form. Just to wrap this all up, we've covered a lot of ground in this first episode of the Culture Scaling Playbook Values episode. There is an accompanying downloadable and interactive PDF that's both a mix of show notes, key points, links to key documents, like the Rocked Handbook, for instance, as well as prompts to ask yourself as you apply some of the learnings to your own real-world setting. This PDF will be available as a click-through in both the podcast player, but also available on the TDM website. So to recap this episode, we traversed the importance of scaling culture, then took a dive into the topic of values, when to set them, how to codify them, how to live them and test them, and finally the often asked question, if in fact you can change them. Scaling is hard. Scaling a culture is the hardest part of this, and not just the most rewarding, but also the single biggest unlock a fast-growing company can have. If I was to leave you with one quote to wrap this all together, it'd be this one from Catherine McConnell.
When you're hiring, you know, 50 plus people a month, you personally can't have that impact as a founder. And so the way you can do that is through your mission, your purpose, and your values, and making sure they're clearly understood, making sure they're lived by everyone in the company, and making sure that, you know, externally people know what they are. And so they become your scaling engine.
We'll see you for the next episode of our Culture Scaling Playbook. It's going to be focused on the key elements of great hiring and retention. I'm Ed Cowan. I hope you enjoyed this very special episode. Of course, as always, for more insights, please visit the TDM website, tdmgrowthpartners.com.